I assume no other bands at this point had a band member who was hanging upside down and playing tambourines that were...
No, no, we were way ahead of Kiss and everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about a show called B-Sharp Beat, a TV show.
Sounds familiar. Yep.
Were you on that?
We did a couple of shows for Jim Lopez, but I can't remember which ones we did. But we were not, as you'll see by some of our advertising, we were really sponsored by Gibson, and he was Fender.
So you didn't. So where did you buy your musical equipment?
From Len's Guitar City.
And then also Frank, one of our guitar players, had a Gibson store. And that's what made us better than the other bands, because they would have, not better than the other bands, but we would. There was a whole bunch of arena, like Aldridge Arena, Battle of the Bands. Gibson Guitar would set up our equipment. We would walk on stage, play, and leave, while the other bands would have to do their band boy stuff and all that. And that made us look a lot more professional.
And there was another place that we went to that, like the Castaways, I want to say Accents, Underbeats, it was Tressman's on Lindale, 66. Mm-hmm. Irv Tressman and his brother sponsored us all the way. And that was the time where we didn't have a dime to our name, and they gave us credit. So we owe a lot, and I think a lot of groups, especially the South groups, owe a lot to Irv Tressman when he was alive. And that, because, like I said, I got Farfisa organs with, what do you call them, the big music, oh, I can't think of the name right now, the Hammond organ type.
The Leslie.
Leslie, that went, yeah.
Leslie Amps.
Yep, that went with it on credit.
Mm-hmm. You could play a Farfisa keyboard through a Leslie amp?
Absolutely. Farfisa and Leslie had a gadget that could be put together to give you that full Hammond sound without that heavy Hammond carrying it around. And so I personally feel that the Tressman music had a lot to do with the beginning, long before Lopez at B Sharp. Lopez did come in strong, but that was after the music scene had really started developing here, in my opinion.
We're talking 1964, the year the Rolling Stones played here live. Prior to that, in February 1964, the Beatles appeared on Ed Sullivan. Were you guys watching?
Yes,
I think I did. I'm not sure.
What was the impact of the Beatles playing on Ed Sullivan and being on the radio?
Well, if I remember right, I watched it from Paterson, New Jersey, because I was playing the Garfield Strip, where Little Anthony and them were playing, and that's the one year that I was fronting for one group. And I wasn't impressed that much with the Beatles. I was a Rolling Stone. I was... Mm-hmm.
Animals.
The Animals. I was what do you call it? The Zombies. Mm-hmm. I was into that.
How about you, Mickey?
I was the Stones from, and I still am. Mm-hmm. I've seen every Stones performance, starting at Dance-Land. So I've always been a Rolling Stones over the Beatles.
Describe to me a little bit of the difference between the Beatles and the Stones.
I like the Stones because they're a show group. They keep your eyes moving, and that's what, you know, I thought we were. We were a show group compared to just standing up there playing.
Danny, what was your impression?
Great songwriters.
The Beatles?
But never really wanted to do any of their songs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we had great groups out of Minneapolis, like... I thought Zippy Kaplan, Ron, that you mentioned, that presented the guitar to the Beatles, and that...
Ron Bowen.
Yeah. They did a great version of them. I like the way the Stones dressed. Mm-hmm. And I used to go to Bo Gentry's in Beverly Hills way back, where they had the mod scene, and the Stones would close the store down for 4 hours buying clothes, and... we were into that. It was between an English mod and a California look that I liked.
Do you guys play outstate or different states too at this time?
Yes, but we picked our states.
Okay.
States with a lot of media attention.
That was your focus?
Yes.
Media attention.
Absolutely. Because I figured I would end up doing something later in life. So the more recognition and notoriety I would get, it'll open the doors for me.
Let's talk about your very first 45. Do you remember what year that was?
1966, approximately.
And what songs did you record?
One by Dion called Little Diane, and then an original called Believe Me.
Who wrote Believe Me?
Myself and Frank Marino.
And that came out on the IRC label. Who owned that label?
It was a Chicago company.
Where did you record that?
In Chicago.
Do you remember the name of the studio?
I thought it was International Recording Company because right next door, the Bo Brummels were playing. Not playing, but recording.
And just for the record, who's playing what on this first 45 and who's doing the vocals?
I'm doing the vocals with Frank Marino. And Bob Gagne did the background. Frank was playing lead guitar. Bob Gagne was playing bass. CeeDee Van Dusen was playing drums. I was playing keyboard. Mickey was playing tambourine.
Now, a lot of the local bands were recording at K-Bank. How did you guys wind up in Chicago?
Connections.
Okay. So that record comes out. Do you get any airplay here in town?
We got up to number 15 on it. Three of the stations. And I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Something in the Night Train or something was his name on WDGY or something. Bobby Wayne or Bobby something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so your first 45 is out from 1966. What's going on with the band now in this time period?
Growing and doing that. And started traveling about the end of 65 to 66.
Did you have a band vehicle?
Yes. What sponsored by Gibson. It was a van.
A Chevy van.
Yeah.
That I had to drive.
Mickey, you were the driver.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and the heater went out. We played Trollhagen. The heater went out, and we had to drive back, and I froze.
But and then also when we headed for California, our Gibson had bought a brand new van. And we were on Sunset Boulevard and that, and we pulled up right in front of the London Fog and parked it. And that's how we became friends with the Doors, because they had a van, but it was a Volkswagen. And it was parked outside the front of the London Fog, and they were playing that night. So that's the first time I saw what became the new Hollywood look. Morrison was wearing, I called it a grandpa t-shirt with slippers. And it sort of looks like what was in the movie, but the band played behind the bar.
What venue was this?
London Fog. On the corner was a Whiskey A Go-Go, then he had the London Fog, and across the street was Pandora's Box, which had a group called Mothers of Invention.
Gazzari's was there?
Oh, yeah, that's down the street with Pat and Lolly Vegas, who later became Redbone. They were friends of ours. And then they did the Teenage Fair, Pat and Lolly Vegas, the California Teenage Fair at the Palladium, which was across the street from the Moulin Rouge, that at that time was having nothing but the English acts coming in, Zombies, Kinks, so on and so on.
How does your band go over in Los Angeles?
Well, Frank Zappa watched us four nights in a row and said, "What is happening?"
And what venue were you playing?
We were at the Whiskey. The Bo Brummels were the show act. And Johnny Rivers was the main star, because Johnny was at here. That time, it was part owner of the Whiskey A Go-Go. Oh, and there was the new sound coming out. A guy by the name, which we all know now, Leslie West Mountain.
Okay, so we get to your second 45 here. What year was that?
1967.
And that's on the Carnaby label?
Yes.
The two songs are what?
Triangles.
That's
the side B.
And the A side is?
Under My Thumb.
The Stone song.
Song. Mm-hmm. got permission to do it, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be, David Zimmerman called. David was our manager. Like, at that time, the big booking agent was Harry Beacom. And he did those outdoor festivals, if you remember, at Midway Stadium. They called, and the Stones said, no, we're not putting it out as a 45.
You heard it on an album.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I love the song.
But Between our version was completely different than the Stones.
And as long as we put it on the Carnaby label, we were okay to do it.
Okay, and tell me about the B-side, Triangles.
That was written by Skip Dolan and myself, and I want to give Frank Marino a little bit of credit. He helped on the arrangement and things like that.
Skip Dolan from The Accents.
From The Accents, mm-hmm. who was always a favorite musician of mine.
Mm-hmm. And where was this 45 recorded?
This would be back at your place that you had mentioned, K-Bank, but I think it was called something else.
Universal Audio?
No, something else.
Mike's Side?
Cookhouse? No, that was later.
It was the four. So that was at the. It was at the K Bank building.
Yeah, building. Okay. On Nicollet Avenue and 26, whatever.
That record comes out. Do you get any airplay with that record?
Nationally.
It was promoted nationally.
Yep.
I'm reading a newspaper article here called "Platter Pull" by Bill Deal, and he says your band appeared on the Mike Douglas TV show.
Yes.
How did that go?
Well, for us. Because from there, we were in New York, and we played for Trudy Heller's Trick and Joel Heller's nightclub. And Joel Thanks Heller's was in the Village, and she was right next door to Jack Dempsey's. And she was part of, let's call it, the funny people, meaning very much mafia, very much. And with us was a group called The Music Machine.
Talk Talk?
Yep. Psychedelic, there's another one, Psychedelic Lollipop was the other group that had that as a hit. And we did very well there. We played at the Latin Quarters.
Having records out on the charts, did that increase the number of people who came out to see you guys play live?
Yes. When we played in New York, we were right next door to the Scene, where the Doors were playing. We had the waiting lines, but it was mostly Minnesota people from flight attendants that saw us at the Alps. There was one time, I think we had about 100 flight attendants in that fly-in.
Tell me about the Alps.
Most fun place I played.
Yeah.
Why, Mickey?
Well, I can't go into a whole bunch of reasons why, but it was always packed. We just...
Good people to work for.
And, I mean, we felt free of whatever we wanted to play. I mean, they loved us there.
No one told you to turn down?
No.
Once in a while,
But that was a dispute going on with the trailer park because he originally tried for the liquor license there, and they turned him down and gave it to the other.
This was next door to a trailer park?
Collins Park.
Oh, so there was issues about...
No. And that was most of the issues were because there were so many people and they were parking... In his spot.
I've driven by the building after it was the Alps, of course, and it's a very odd building, an A-frame chalet off of 494 in Bloomington. Give me a little picture of what it was like inside.
Packed.
You couldn't and move. Big. Two floors.
Two floors, and you were halfway between the two floors.
And you could get 700-800 people in if you wanted to.
And it was, at that time... We had the nightclub scene locked up, and we would go out and we would play arenas, and the teeny boppers would always try to get into the building because it was 21 and older.
For alcohol.
Yes. And they were, so they made it look like it was really, really packed so more people would come.
See, in our era of that time of the Alps and that, some fun things were starting to happen where people were starting to do the Battle of the Bands. They had done it earlier, but it wasn't at the degree of sensation like they had it, like the Aldridge Arena, where you'd have 7-8 bands, thousands of kids. And it started really happening, and times changed, you know, when the hippie movement came in,
I've heard that the Alps would draw a lot of employees from Northwest Airlines.
Yes, absolutely, because they all lived around there, and they could walk there, the new flight attendants and that. And they basically had, the Alps was very good to us. They had allow us to have weekends off in order to do the higher paying shows. And basically, my memory serves that there were only three house bands rotating, us, the Jokers Wild, and there was one other, but that group later broke up.
Who was the owner? Who owned the Alps?
Mike Peterson, and I forget the other guy's name. Mike was more the outgoing owner, but there were two guys.
Mm-hmm. Now, are these did people dance there, or was it more of a concert?
Dance. Down below. So the stage would look down at the dancers.
Ah, okay. So you were elevated above.
Way above.
The dance floor. What went on the upper level floor?
Drinking.
Drinking, and people would find areas that they'd dance in. Mm-hmm. That type of thing.
Okay. Tell me about some other places. Did you play The Prison?
Yes.
In Burnsville?
Mm-hmm.
What was that place like?
I liked it. I think it was...
Two stages?
Yeah, one at each end. When we played there, one time we played there with Lee Michaels. The other time was with Joe Cocker and the Grease Band. Mm-hmm. We didn't play there a whole lot, but we knew if we could be on the show with a national act, we'd get the recognition in the paper. And at that time, Alan Hobart was a writer for the Star, so whenever there was a national act, I could get him to write a story about us.
And Don Morrison, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How about the Purple Barn?
Loved it.
Where was that?
494, and now it'd be close to 169.
Was it a real barn?
Yeah.
Painted purple?
I believe the front of it was, yeah. Hmm. And Bill Roselansky was one of the owners, and I believe Bill Mack was a small owner in it too, and Bill Mack is right now throughout the world known as one of the top artist. He's been on, you know, the Lifestyle of the Rich and Famous and that. He does those paintings. I call them paintings, but they're really art sculptures that sort of jump out 3D type things, and they're all in white. But I've seen him with Salvador Dali and these people in Hawaii.
Are you on the ballroom circuit too?
Yes.
The Prom?
Yeah, very much so with Dick Clay.
The Marigold?
The Marigold, by the time we really started getting our notoriety, was strictly a Marsh.
Oh, okay.
Marsh it was starting to, I think, fade. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it was fading.
The Bell Ray?
Loved it. Yep. Tony Jamber. Loved him. Great guy.
Ryan's Ballroom?
A little bit there, but I think that was sort of disappearing. Where we would play close to Ryan's was Virge Miller's place called The Rusty Nail. And what was that?
Well, and before that, though, we played pretty much at more downstairs.
Yeah, that was a little bit later than with Ryan's, yeah.
Do you recall the biggest crowd you ever brought in, number-wise?
It was a KDWB party in St. Paul, mm-hmm. where they had the music machine and that, and I believe... in St. Paul. This other was where we drew about, well, not us, all the bands drew about, I think there was about 8,000-9,000 people.
Was this an outdoor event?
No, it was indoors.
Where?
Was that Aldridge Arena?
No, that for what you see there is Aldridge Arena, right there. But this was downtown St. Paul. Okay. And it was a KDWB party that they had, a carnival, winter carnival type party.
Okay, back to your records here. You have another 45 that comes out in 1967. Tell me about that record.
Let's see. Which one was
this
that?
This one came out on the Hand label.
Oh, okay. That record.
What songs were on there?
One Eye Closed and Thinking of You. Beyond being on it, we really had nothing more to do. We didn't own it. We didn't write it. And Joey Southern was part of it. And that's the first recognition that we had with the new group. The only original people then was Mickey and myself. But that's when Carl Bradley started coming onto the scene with The Reasons, about 67, something like that.
So you had some personnel changes here.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So who's
times are changing, and we had to get an R&B feel because of Temptations and that were coming, but we wanted to be more like the Chambers Brothers, who had Can't Turn You Loose, People Get Ready, Rod Stewart hit. So we went with Jimmy Lawrence, Chuck Edwards.
Hold on, tell me what they played too.
Okay, Jimmy Lawrence was basically a singer, played congas, along with Mickey playing congas and tambourine. Chuck Edwards was lead guitar.
Ross
Ingram was bass. Carl Bradley played keyboard and came out front. We'd switch. When he was out front, I'd be on the keyboards. And we started out with Steve Maurer, that besides Pete Hubert was drums, but Steve also was one of the few that played a double bass head on drums.
That was rare at the time?
At that time, mm-hmm. It was. And that was one of the things that I enjoyed about the Joker's Wild, is they had uniqueness. In fact, when our drummer that later came in and replaced Steve Maurer, who was a personal friend of Carl Bradley's and Jimmy Lawrence, was Rory Lee. We used Pete Hubert when we did a show around 67, 68 in Duluth with Paul Revere and the Raiders, the Raspberries, and there's some others, because we thought that would be unique. He was still a member, loyal to the Joker's Wild, but he wasn't playing that night. And I said, Carl, let's use something showy, because it was still the original Paul Revere and the Raiders that did all the show steps, Mark Lindsay, and so on.
Tell me about these two songs. Are these original songs or cover songs?
Original.
Who wrote them?
I can't remember the writer's name. The one...
Which one?
One Eye Closed, which is on Google and that, was a song that Richard Branson was trying to get a hold of, by what I'm told, because it had Jimi Hendrix playing lead guitar on it.
He's playing guitar on that record?
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Through Joey Southern.
Were you at... what?
I was at the studio when it was taking place.
Which studio was this at?
One of them was, and one was in L.A.
So the L.A. one was
that's where
I
they
closed.
Got them, yeah. Yeah, and One Eye Closed. Thinking of You was Strictly Here, and I can't remember the name of the studio.
Tell me how Jimi Hendrix ends up playing guitar on this 45.
Personal friend of Joey Southern's. And like I said, Joey was more or less guiding that whole thing. So I was in and I was out, because at that time I was still working on putting together my first involvement with Times Square, which was the old Diamond Lils. So I would shoot in and shoot out. I would sing on it and then leave.
You know, what was Jimi Hendrix like?
My personal opinion, true patriot.
You had time to talk to him?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Were you impressed with his musicianship?
No, because I wasn't that good a musician, so I didn't really understand how good he was. Mm. Now, I met Jimi Hendrix in approximately the first time, and we laughed about that. That's the only common thing. I want to say around 63, 64, he was Joey D's lead guitar player, and he had a ducktail.
Joey D and the Starlighters?
Joey D and the Starlighters.
From out east.
From the Peppermint Lounge. That's where I met him, at the Peppermint Lounge. And because we were playing there, and I was I thought it was unique the way he played, but I wasn't, you know, overly impressed. I was more impressed with Joey D, Brigatti. Both Dave Brigatti and Eddie Brigatti were his dancers at that time,
from the Rascals.
Yes, on that. So it was all, as you can see, a small little clique.
And
what was happening of those guys.
And I assume you liked Joey D because...
Loved him.
Because he was a showman.
Showman, exactly. Mm-hmm.
He used to do the splits.
You could do the splits?
Absolutely.
Without hurting yourself?
Probably still has the same ripped pants that he did when doing it.
Did that happen on occasion?
Absolutely. In fact, we were later when we get into the years, but it was close to 67. We were barred, what was it called, the Boston Band or something. we were barred from any of our songs being played on any of the radios because yes. What happened is Carl and I were dancing. It was on the show with Janis Joplin.
What show?
It was at the Armory.
Yeah, it was Steppenwolf that we were.
No, it was Janis Joplin. And we, in that time, I was wearing leather pants, which wasn't really seen that much with the fringe. And these particular pants were owned by Jim Morrison. Because in 66, when he was arrested in Connecticut for drinking on the street and da-da-da-da, we traded.
You traded pants with Jim Morrison?
Yeah. And
did they fit?
Yeah, we're both skinny. On that. So what happened is I threw my leg up and my pants in the crotch ripped and I fell out. And the people looking to the front thought it was deliberate. Well, Carl's up there jumping on. We were doing From Hair, we call it a skit. Black girls are delicious. We love them through and through. They got licorice lips like candy. They make this white boy feel dandy. Well, then he goes, well, white girls are delicious. I love them through and through. They make this black boy feel real dandy. And then he jumps on the American flag. And they thought this whole thing, we were just doing an insert from Hair. And so KDWB would not play any advertising. So if you talk to ever Gary Jorgensen and them, he wanted to promote us. And it hurt us a little bit because places didn't use us because they couldn't advertise our name on the radio. And I do have an article someplace on the Connie Insider that is stating that. And we had to apologize and apologize and go left and right that we aren't the bad boys and so on and so on. And then finally, some of the advertisers got together and said, you know, maybe it was a mistake, but things like this aren't that bad compared to what else is going on out there with the rock groups.
So tell me about this Times Square project.
At the time, I got the ideas from the Whiskey A Go-Go of having an all-ages area and also drinking. But we needed bigger venues, and when this big venue came there, I knew I could get some of the national acts that we play with to come over and play after the show and advertise on the speaker, you know, at the show, like Janis did. We had Janis Joplin as an example to it. Tim Kerr brought Pat Paulson. He brought the Smothers Brothers, Winters. Johnny and Edgar Winters. Yeah. They all came and played free.
This is your club? Right.
Yeah.
And where is it located?
It was Kitty Corner from the Normandy. A hotel.
And downtown.
And it took up half of that block. It was that big. And Dave Rooney played downstairs jazz. Jack Dow, who owned it.
What was the prior use of the building?
Diamond
Lil's.
It was a nightclub.
Yeah. Okay. Vaudeville shows.
And you purchased the building?
Nope. We rented it.
Okay.
We rented it from Jack Dow.
And you call it Times Square.
Right.
And what year does this club open?
About 68. Late 67s were 67 we're working on it, and I think we had the New Year's Eve there of 68 going into 68 67 going into 68.